Tonight on Arena, Bad Seed Mick Harvey talks to us ahead of his upcoming gig in Dundalk. We review this week's films and a new production of The Weir is under the critical microscope. Our text is, as always, 51551. You can email arena at rte.ie or find us on X at RTE Arena. Films up for review tonight. We will start with Materialists. Materialists is a new rom-com starring Hollywood royalty Dakota Johnson and two of the hottest leading men around, Chris Evans and Pedro Pascal. The story of a matchmaker who has the first world problem of trying to choose between a rich man with whom she has little in common and one with a less healthy bank balance for whom she has a connection. Is love all we need, or is not being overdrawn a little bit more attractive? Love is also the drug in Oslo Stories Love, the second part of a trilogy by Norwegian filmmaker and novelist Dag Johan Haugerud. It's the story of a series of complicated relationships in modern day Oslo. Romance is the last thing on Lynn's mind in Night Always Comes, played by Vanessa Kirby, most recently seen in the Mission Impossible series, and currently Sue Storm in the Fantastic Four movie. She is on the Portland, Oregon breadline, desperately trying to save her special needs brother and her feckless mother, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh. Finally for this week, Nobody 2 is a follow-up to a film almost nobody was expecting to be a hit, where Bob Odenkirk, star of Better Call Saul, has become an unlikely action hero. He plays an ordinary suburban dad who leads a double life as a violent street fighter who hasn't ready to tell us if any of them are worth your time this weekend. Our critics, John McGuire and Dee Malumbi. We're going to go to Materialists first. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. Those are the hopes of the female population of New York in this film. The men are equally fussy, although they're setting aside love and connection in favour of some slightly more practical concerns. Materialists is directed by Celine Song, who wrote and directed the much lauded and loved Past Lives. And it's a film about modern dating. Let's start with a little something from the film.
Love is easy.
Is it? I find it to be the most difficult thing in the world.
That's because we can't help it. It just walks into our lives sometimes.
Are you hitting on me?
Definitely not. But I do think that you would be a great match for a lot of our clients. We need more straight men in New York City. You look about 6 feet tall. How much money do you make?
Just straight up like that.
I make $80,000 a year before taxes. Do you make more or less than that?
More.
I know. Finance, right?
Private equity. Do you want a drink?
Sure.
What do you want?
Coke and beer.
Hey, buddy.
Hi, John.
Working now, obviously, but talk after dinner service?
Yeah.
And that is Dakota Johnson as matchmaker Lucy at the wedding of two of her clients. To each other, she encounters Pedro Pascal's handsome stranger, Harry. And there at the very end, her ex, John, played by Chris Evans. John, maybe start by reminding us what Celine Song did in Past Lives for those people who might have forgotten the film or not seen it. And then set us up, where have we started here?
Past Lives, I suppose, was a very unexpected film. And that's what makes this the probably the most anticipated second film from an American filmmaker of the year. She was Oscar nominated for Past Lives, which remapped that kind of wistful romantic drama, but it crossed it and you saw it through the lens of a very pointed immigrant narrative, the great American story, the great immigrant narrative. And here she assembles a much starrier cast. I mean, Dakota Johnson, Pedro Pascal and Chris Evans. And this is a much lighter and more seductive take on a romantic comedy. She has slightly adjusted genre to romantic comedy. And it's a story of love and regret and expectations set amongst the Manhattan elite. And if you could hear in that clip you just played, Rick, you could hear the soft jazz in the background. Mm-hmm. And there's a very soft jazz feel to a lot of this film, to be honest with you. It feels very smooth. It feels very polished. the cast are, you know, some of the best actors working today. Dakota Johnson's a very likable actress. She's a little stiff and a little cold, but she's a very likable presence in this. Pascal and Evans are floating along. And it opens, funnily enough, with a vignette from prehistory. We're 10,000 years ago, and you've got this Stone Age man presenting a bunch of flowers and a nice sharp, handy piece of sharp flint to his paramour, his hairy paramour. And then in, you know, like Kubrick's Throne Bone in 2001, we're flash forward 10,000 years to Manhattan, where you have a completely changed world. Everybody's only really interested in net worth. Everybody's, what in this dating scene, people are transactional. This is an economy. This is a marketplace. It's not a romantic place at all, really. There's nowhere for a bunch of flowers and a piece of sharp stone. This is about net worth. This is about what you can bring to the table in terms of a relationship. And it's deeply transactional and quite cynical, actually.
I mean, the piece of sharp stone alone might get you arrested. Dee, tell us about Lucy's matchmaking business. It's obviously very high end. She has very net worth clients.
Yeah, that's right. So Lucy Mason, played by Dakota Johnson, is very good at her job. She is responsible for 9 weddings so far, we are told, and working in New York. We learn a little bit about her background, but she does remain something of an enigma. She talks about the fact that she was kind of born and raised poor and still has like college debts and stuff. So it's interesting, even though she does see all these kind of shallow and pickier qualities in her clients, she does care about factors, particularly salary and, you know, the money and the sense of security that comes with that. And that's why she is, you know, drawn to a character like Harry, played by Pedro Pascal, who is a financier. But yeah, I mean, we meet a number of Lucy's male and female clients, and they're very funny little kind of talking head interviews. You know, they have high standards when it comes to matters of age. There's one 48-year-old man that we meet who insists he will only date 20-something-year-olds. And he does say, quote, even 29 is pushing it, which I find like very amusing. Also discussion about height and how 6 foot something is really just asking for the bare minimum, you know. So it's a bit sad, but that is the world that we live in. Like John was saying there, just the transactional aspect of it. Another man describes how he wants the body of one woman, the career of another, but he still wants this, you know, dream woman to share in his interests and his TV tastes. Lucy even jokes that, oh, I must be Frankenstein putting this woman together for you. So yeah, they're quite like amusing little scenes like that. And to be honest, I found that the comedy and the drama probably came more so from the aspect of materialist that was following Lucy's storyline and her career, rather than the actual romantic relationships and the love triangle, which I felt was like a little dull at times or something. It just wasn't quite working for me.
Yeah, Chris Evans and Pedro Pascal.
But the meet cutes, or is it meets cutes? She meets the two of them at the same time. And from there, you're spinning off into, like Dee says, love triangle, but it's a deeply acute triangle. I mean, there's really no, once we get into who these people really are, and we spend far more time with the Chris Evans character, John, this penniless actor who's now an even more broke waiter against the hedge fund manager, private equity millionaire in his penthouse suite, who's a really quite a boring man. He's quite a boring character, and he doesn't have a lot to offer somebody like Lucy, this character, other than financial security. But this is the hub of the story, really, is that this is a mercenary economy. This is, and that's, Lucy is playing an algorithm. She is trying to match. This is a job Song apparently did herself for a while. She did this job in New York, and she's trying to match people through an algorithm. And then she is presented with the person who would match her best and the person that she wouldn't match with at all. So it's swipe left, swipe right, or whatever the kids do nowadays in this romantic drama, in this kind of almost Woody Allen-ish kind of romantic milieu that she creates, this kind of fantasy Manhattan.
For both of you, chemistry is always the key as to whether or not a film like this works. Is there any?
I didn't find any. No, no. And it's a shame because I think that Dakota Johnson, Chris Evans and Pedro Pascal in their respective roles are all excellent. You know, you look at Chris Evans into his like dreamy eyes and, you know, he's like a little puppy dog and he is very sweet. Pedro Pascal as this, you know, kind of rich, debonair kind of character works well. And Dakota Johnson, I always find like quite, there's just something about her that's always quite charismatic and quite likable, you know, aside from the Ellen DeGeneres interview, of course, that kind of, that she's probably more infamous for now. Like she is quite a likable actress, yeah. I find. All
I think
three
she's
of them
quite
are
cool
terrific.
And she's quite clipped. Yeah. And she's very professional in this until it's her own heart that's at play mm-hmm. and her own heart that enters the market. But Song, and like Lucy, I suppose, Song is coming at the romantic comedy from an analytical perspective and she's paying service to our expectations of what we see when we watch romance on screen. And she's reveling in that simple pleasure of watching good-looking people fall in love with each other in cinema. I mean, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But when you're updating the cliches of a romantic comedy for an era when everything, even our heart's desire, has a ticket price, has a value, the results are not nearly as tender or as keenly observed, I suppose, as Past Lives. This is a much more commercial film and it feels like it has been, you know, algorithmed a bit itself that to fit what the expectations of the market. Okay.
And I do wonder if it's the fact that, you know, writer-director Celine Song is kind of at the heart of this, because the part of the movie that felt the best and the most kind of genuine and the most interesting was kind of the matchmaking element of the story. And that's where, you know, she herself had a brief career as a matchmaker. So that's where it is more personal and more personable. And that was what worked so well about Past Lives, is that it really felt like someone was pouring their heart and soul onto the screen for us to witness. And one of the most kind of heart-wrenching moments in Materialist kind of comes with this twist after an incident with a client, which leaves Lucy broken and cynical. And I mean, that moment in the film had me much more moved than anything that happened the two male leads.
Far beyond the dreams of John B. Keane down in Lyra Crumpon, that's what it is. This kind of matchmaking it's very hard to relate it, to be honest with you. Okay. Somebody in their $16 million penthouse mansion.
They're not supposed to be relatable, John,
it's a tough one.
Out of 5 stars for both of you?
2 out of 5 for me. There were a number of elements of it that didn't work. Even stylistically, you know, she kind of uses this like slow kind of camera movement and shots, which work so well in Past Lives when you have those lingering moments, but it didn't quite work here because she is trying to make a commercial romantic comedy, but is trying to make something a bit kind of personal as well. And I just, the other thing about it that kind of rubbed me up the wrong way is it thinks it's a lot more profound than I think it actually is. So yeah, it'd be 2 stars for me.
I was a little more generous. I would say this is a 3-star movie. This is a solid film, and nature abhors the cynic, and the Lucy character has to learn, and she does, and we follow that progress through the film. I think Johnson is very watchable in it. So 3 for me.
Okay. We're going to look at maybe a slightly more Scandinavian sensibility in Oslo Stories Love. It's part of a loosely connected trilogy. It looks at the dating game as something far more complicated. Dee, where do we start here? As one of the characters says in the film, it kicks off when a urologist and a geologist meet at a party.
Yeah, so this is an interesting one because I wouldn't say it has kind of a conventional like storyline or anything like that, but I think the easiest way to kind of describe it is at the center of this story really are two work colleagues, Marianne, who is a doctor, and Tor, who is a nurse. And these two characters kind of typically avoid relationships. One night they meet on a ferry where Tor kind of talks about how he has these kind of casual encounters on Tinder or Grindr, as it happens to be. And Marianne kind of considers this idea of looking at spontaneous intimacy and maybe kind of having that disconnect from relationships for herself. And she's wondering if that's something that'll kind of work for her. And they both continue to, you know, share these observations about sex and relationships, both with one another and with others. And then another element of the story is the fact that Marianne's best friend Heidi is kind of setting her up on dates with this geologist named Ole, who's kind of divorced, and he's a father of 2.
John, it's a slow-burning, talky, dialogue-driven film. Is that a good thing?
Oh, yeah, it is for me, Rick. I like this movie a lot. And what I like most about it, put the characters to one side, put the story to one side, this is a city film. This is a film about Oslo. It's and the entire trilogy, really, are films that are very rooted in the place where they've come from. And, you know, you're looking at the city.
It looks gorgeous. You're on the ferry, so you see it from the water. You see where they live. The geologist literally explains the geography and the topography of the place. But then you get a real sense of how these people are, what their moods are, how they interact with one another. You get a real sense through the Heidi character of how the culture of the city, you know, she gives us a walking tour of the statues at the start of the film. So you get a real sense of how all of these things are combined. You know, I think it's just a great city film. The story is the story. There's elements of it that I was more interested in than others, but the characters and where the characters are placed, I was absolutely fascinated by. I think it's really, really interesting.
And the ferry is almost a character in and of itself, T.
Yeah, I suppose so. The ferry is like this really interesting space of possibility that both Marianne kind of explores as she eventually kind of embarks on a one-night stand, which kind of has, I don't want to give it away, but it kind of has like negative and positive implications, both of which she kind of has to like think through, I suppose, in her own mind, and she's kind of talking through with Heidi even, and Tor as well. Tor in particular, he meets this man named Bjorn on it, who he talks to about kind of the pros and cons between, you know, casual sex versus having one partner, and their paths actually cross again at the hospital where Tor works. And Tor actually is a really, for me, like a standout character, because I found it so interesting how you did kind of interpret him as maybe kind of a bit cold, the fact that he has this kind of like approach to sex and relationships, but he emerges to be this actually very sensitive character. He's extremely patient, he's extremely kind, thoughtful and caring. So
it's like an outreach worker.
He's lovely.
Yeah, he really is, and he's such a handsome man as well. Now we have to say he's a devastatingly handsome man,
and he knows it. Talks about it himself in the film, and is perfectly happy.
Absolutely, perfectly happy with it. But this is these kind of characters. These are thoughtful characters. These are grown up characters. This is a thoughtful and grown up film, and it. They have different emotional needs, and they're talking about how they are best satisfied outside the standard cinematic schematic of true love and marriage and babies and all that kind of stuff. And one person's happy ever after is not necessarily another person's happy ever after. And I think this film very much embraces that.
Yeah.
And the contrivances, the Haggard's story is not as it happens, a million miles away from materialists. But this warm and humanist approach, I think, is very Norway, very Oslo, and it has very little of the cynicism and the kind of sophisticated ironies that we see in Materialist.
Yeah.
Very different film.
Just maybe briefly, John, it is a trilogy. I've seen Dreams, the earlier film came out a couple of weeks ago, the one that won the Golden Bear at Berlin. As far as I can see, there's only one character in common, and he's just incredibly briefly in the other film.
Yeah.
Does it matter to people if they haven't seen?
I don't think so. The film, like Godard says, should have a beginning, a middle, and an end. A trilogy should have the same, but not necessarily in that order. And here we're seeing this film out of order, actually. This, I think, is the last film, and it's the one that's been released in the middle. I think three self-contained films that are only connected thematically, not necessarily by characters or storylines. I think that complementary approach is really very interesting for such what is a massive project then. You're talking about 7 hours of film, really around the same kind of themes. What does it mean to be alive in the world and looking for love?
Stars out of five?
4 for me. I thought this was really very good and very well acted as well, I have to say.
Okay, indeed.
Really well acted.
3.5 for me. Marianne and Tor's kind of core relationship really struck me in particular. I found it interesting even because, you know, John kind of referenced the Norwegian sensibility there. As they're talking about kind of their dating lives and just being transparent, it struck me so much. If this was like an American movie, this conversation would be full of like clever quips and jokes and stuff like that. But it's all very grounded. It's all very real. And it's just a film full of organic conversation and very pleasant people. I think you'll leave this film with a big smile on your face.
Yeah,
actually.
The last scene is lovely too.
The
final scene is really lovely. Yeah.
Okay, we'll take a look at Nobody 2, the new film with Bob Odenkirk in it, and Night Always Comes in just a minute.
Hi, John Creedon here. Unfortunately, I'm unavailable at the moment, but you'll get me at 7:30 on RTE Radio 1. Thank you.
He may not pick up the phone, but he's always there when you need him. The John Creedon Show. Weeknights from 7:30 on RTE Radio 1 and the RTE Radio app.
Is your little one starting big school this September? At Dunn Stores, we've got you covered for those memorable milestones. From waving goodbye at the gate to snapping that first proud photo in their new uniform. Feel confident as they take their next big step with quality schoolwear. pick up a 3-pack of Playproof polos from €5. Pair these with Easy Care joggers also from €5, plus a comfy sweatshirt from €3.75. Shop back to school in-store and online now. Dunn Stores. Always better value. Terms and conditions apply.
Bosch. Appliances you can rely on. Choose from Bosch's 5-year warranty range of home appliances. For more information, go online to powercity.ie. T's and C's apply.
It's the delicious chocolate bubbles in Aero that make it a joy to eat. Aero. Feel the bubbles melt.
RGE Radio 1.
The five-star, sold-out Regent's Park production of Fiddler on the Roof comes to Borgosh Energy Theatre for 2 weeks only from the 7th of October. Featuring the iconic songs If I Were a Rich Man, Sunrise, Sunset and Matchmaker. Winner of Best Musical Revival at this year's Olivier Awards. Don't miss this critically acclaimed masterpiece, set to be the theatrical event of the year. Tickets available now. BorgoshEnergyTheatre.ie.
Entertainment updates on RGE Radio 1.
This is Thursday Night's Arena. John McGuire and Dee Malumbi are with me looking at this week's movies. Dee, Nobody, and that's the name of the movie as opposed to Nobody, was a surprise hit from 2021 in order to not confuse people. But because it was such a hit, there has to be a sequel. Nobody 2 has Bob Odenkirk in it as a mild-mannered dad who leads a double life as a cold-blooded assassin, and rightly so. Dee, what happens in it?
Yeah, so very exciting stuff. So I suppose it kicks off from the events of the last film, where we, you know, stopped off in the first Nobody. Hutch had kind of retired, but now he's back to work as an assassin. He's obviously a lot more satisfied with his work, but now his wife is upset because he's never at home. He's basically gone from early morning to the middle of the night. And Hutch kind of recognizes this. He recognizes that there's distance growing between him and his wife and his children. So he says, you know what, it's time that we all pack it up and go on vacation. And they head out to Plumersville, which is where he kind of has this childhood connection with. And they also bring Grandpa, who is played by the fabulous Christopher Lloyd.
Do we need a new action hero? Do we need, is Hutch a decent example of that?
I mean, look, I'm not going to lie. As you're watching Nobody, the thing that irks me the most about this series is it's trying so, so hard to be like the new John Wick. You know how John Wick is kind of on a hiatus now. I know it had that spin-off movie, Ballerina, earlier in the year, but I don't think that kind of made great waves or anything like that. So they're very much trying to make Bob Odenkirk, a.k.a. Hutch, kind of the new kind of action hero. And here Hutch is in action very, very frequently. And it is kind of ridiculous. He's this single unarmed man who's constantly taking out entire gangs of armed men, whether they have swords or they have guns. Like, it is all kind of silly. You do have to suspend your disbelief and just accept that this is one of those ridiculous action movies. If you're not biting, though, you're going to find this as ridiculous as everything that's kind of come before.
I'm absolutely sure I'm going to watch this on a Saturday night.
Yeah, I'm just probably going to watch this
movies.
Too.
Right? Yeah. Question. Yeah. The film's directed by an Indonesian filmmaker, Timo Chianto. What does he bring to the film as a director? What's his style like in terms of the action sequences?
Yeah, he just delivers action scene after action scene, I suppose, which is what we're looking for. And one of the sequences that particularly stood out to me takes place on a boat dock, which isn't like the military boat dock. It's literally just one of those like silly, rubbishy like tourist boats with it like duck stuck on top. But yeah, that I found very amusing. And people might also be interested to know that Lendina, who is the main antagonist in this film, is played in the film by Sharon Stone. So Sharon Stone makes an appearance as the antagonist. Don't think it's her best role. I thought she was like maybe going a bit over the top and ridiculous here, but I could tell that she was having a bit of fun with it as well. So it is one of those films that it is what it is. You know exactly what you're kind of getting here. There's nothing kind of profound that you're going to come away with. It is probably largely forgettable, to be honest. I'm kind of surprised that Nobody got a sequel as it is, but I think it is just because there is a bit of a gap in the action genre right now, because we did have the John Wick franchise. I would argue that before that, kind of the Taken series and all the like spin-off dad in action
films. This is the middle-aged man. Late middle-aged man.
People like John and I are going to be the target audience when we want something that's not going to challenge
us. I like these movies too.
And Joe, we need a moment. Talk to me just about the action, maybe very, very briefly. Where does it fall on a scale of comic book violence to actual hardcore violence?
Oh, probably, yeah, probably somewhere in between, I would say. Like, if you have any kind of, you know, aversion to blood or violence or anything like that, I would probably stay away from this one.
Stars out of five?
It's 3 out of 5. Like, it's a solid action movie. And like I said, if you're a fan of the genre, it's a bit of fun. But I don't think, I don't see Hutch kind of becoming the next John Wick, but I suppose time will tell.
Okay, our final film this week is Night Always Comes. You might remember Vanessa Kirby as the cut-glass, chain-smoking young Princess Margaret in The Crown. Since then, she has moved on to characters that couldn't be further from members of the British aristocracy. John, particularly in this film, what's the story?
This is reunited. She's the producer on this as well, Vanessa Kirby. She's taken the Crown director, Benjamin Caron, The Night Always Comes, an adaptation of the Willie Volutin novel of the same title. And this is for Netflix. You'll see it on Netflix. And it's about as far from the goings-on in Buckingham Palace as you could get. Kirby plays a woman called Lynette. She's in her late 20s. She's living in poverty in an increasingly gentrified Portland, Oregon. And she has to risk everything over the course of a single night to secure a home for her mother, who's played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, and her adult brother, who's played by Zach Gottsagen, who has a developmental disability. She's been looking after them, working 3 or 4 jobs on either side of the law for the last couple of years, trying to scrape together the deposit to buy the house that they have rented as a family for years. She's been given an opportunity, you know, to get a bit of property. This is a universal story. The universality of it goes without saying. So she's been trying to get this money together. And then Jennifer Jason Leigh's character spends all the money on a new car instead. So she's got 24 hours to raise $25,000 by calling in favors, by taking, you know, getting money that she's lent from people. It doesn't really matter where she gets this from. She is determined over the course of a single night to get $25,000 together. And so she sets off in an odyssey through the city to beg favors from friends and clients, call in old debts and break the law. And it gets a bit ridiculous, actually, the deeper into illegality that she gets as an ordinary woman. But I suppose it's Kirby, this kind of urgent performance that she can deliver. She's a very internalized actress. She really, you know, you feel the power of it coming off her a lot, particularly here in this kind of exploration of the great lie of trickle-down economics and what a tattered mess America is in a lot of places. And she has that empathy and that urgency, and that steadies the film through some fairly unlikely developments later on, and some thin character work around her as well, which is a bit of a shame. But there's a real energy to her and a dangerous unpredictability to this Lynette character. Kirby plays her extremely well. And
and what about Jennifer Jason Leigh?
She gets 3 scenes. I mean, it's hard to say. It's very hard to gauge. She doesn't have a lot to do. She's the trigger of the mess, but we don't really interact very much with her. We see a lot more later on of Zach Gottsagen, who's an actor with Down syndrome, and he's really very good and really heartbreaking in some of the stuff that he has to witness and the kind of things that he has to struggle to understand about just how deep of a mess they're in. And by extension, I suppose, we're all in. I mean, this is that universality in the story resonates far beyond the streets of Portland. We can all relate to it here. But it is that kind of examination of just how poor America is. We have this, if you watch Materialists, you think they're all hedge fund managers. They're really not. And that kind of exploration of poverty at street level in the US is rare enough in American cinema. So it has value there, certainly.
So was it something that you enjoyed? How many stars are we talking?
Yeah, 3 stars. I wanted to like this film a lot more than I did. I like Volutin as a writer. I like the kind of stories that he wants to tell. And there is a lot of energy to this film and a lot of motivation, certainly, in following the Lynette character. But some of the directions that the story takes later are just hard to take.
John McGuire and Dee Malumbi, thanks a million for coming into us again as usual.
Mick Harvey is a renowned musician, songwriter and producer whose name will also be forever linked with Nick Cave's. For over 30 years, they were musical partners, first in the iconic post-punk band The Birthday Party and then, of course, in The Bad Seeds. Mick is coming to Ireland in September to play three gigs, the first of which is part of a festival in Dundalk. These Are the Waves, celebrating the music of the late Conway Savage. Conway was piano, keyboardist and backing singer with Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds from 1990 until his untimely death in 2018. And he was also an artist in his own right. He had a long relationship with Ireland. I'm delighted Mick Harvey joins me now on the line from Melbourne. Mick, thanks for joining us on Arena.
Hi. Yes, hello, Rick. Good to be here.
We'll come to Conway Savage in a moment, but I wanted to start off by playing a little of The Mercy Seat. It's a track you co-wrote with Nick Cave in 1988 for Tender Prey, the album. You left The Bad Seeds in 2009, but The Mercy Seat, and for a very good reason, is still one of those songs that's pretty much the staple of a Nick Cave live gig. How did you and Nick go about creating that song together in studio?
Oh, well, it was kind of, it's one of the rare songs that was constructed in pieces, in that, normally The Bad Seeds would be recording live in the, back then would be recording live in the studio, playing pretty much as a live band, but that one was constructed as a kind of experimental piece. So the elements of who wrote what are quite difficult to decipher or to remember in a way. It kind of was put together like a Lego piece or something, and transformed into a song after certain experimentations were undertaken. So we were both putting things into the soup, as it were. So it kind of came together miraculously.
And that's The Mercy Seat, Nick Cave and The Bad Seeds from the Tender Prey album in 1988. Mick Harvey is on the phone with me now. Mick, you were a co-founder with Nick Cave of both The Birthday Party and then The Bad Seeds. But where did the two of you first meet?
Oh, we were at school together. So the Nick arrived. I was already at Caulfield Grammar School in Melbourne, and he arrived in, I think, what would have been called Form 2 back then, probably Year 8, whatever you call it over there. No idea. But he arrived then, and we were about 14 or something. So I met him gradually over time. It was quite odd because by the next year we were in a band together at school, which is essentially the band which became The Boys Next Door and then The Birthday Party. So we were already playing together from 1973. So, it was strange for me because in a way when I finally left The Bad Seeds, it was as if I was leaving the band that I'd always been in. It was the band I'd been in from the beginning, in a way. There was a kind of trajectory there which was consistent, and, so it was quite a big move for me to make, to actually finally leave the company of Nick and having him as the singer and so forth.
Well, why do you think that happened? Was it one of those things where the two of you just clicked immediately?
Oh, I think it's no, not at all. No, we didn't. Certainly was no immediate clicking. In fact, I think he was, I was just kind of in the band as one of the guitar players, and Nick's collaborative things were stronger with some of the other members for quite a while. It wasn't really until late in The Birthday Party, in about 83 or something, that we finally started working really more directly together on songs and had a stronger connection. And I suppose that's why it carried over into once The Birthday Party broke up. Nick kind of asked me to continue working with him, and because that had something had kind of developed over that last year or so in that band, and he wanted me there in The Bad Seeds because he saw I was relatively versatile and didn't bring a lot of baggage with me. A lot of egotistical baggage.
And I know that's around about, so 1983 when you formed The Bad Seeds. I want to skip forward ever so slightly because we're here to talk about Conway Savage pretty much.
Indeed, yes.
Where was the band at when you recruited him? Around about 1990, do I have that right?
Pretty much. We'd recorded The Good Son in Brazil, of all places, and that had come out, and we were embarking on the tour in support of that album. And we'd had Kid Congo Powers had been in the band, which meant that we had two guitar players who were non-traditional, non-orthodox guitar players, which was interesting in itself. But he was also about to be going off on tour with the Gun Club all year. And we'd sort of had a hard time with the pianist that we had there, Roland Rolf. Nick kind of found it difficult to work with him. So we kind of went into reconfiguring the band to present that tour. And we hired in Martin Casey on the bass and Conway Savage, both of whom I kind of knew from Australia. So I was the one who hired them. And he was in the band after that till his untimely departure.
And what made you think
from all of us?
Yeah, and what made you think initially that he'd be such a good fit for the band?
Well, you never know with these kinds of things, and the Bad Seas has been described as a pirate ship, and it's a bit like that. So it's a bit hard to know how people are going to fit in. I kind of felt that he had I knew his piano playing style from a couple of the bands he'd been in, and I thought he could bring something quite interesting. But the problem with any pianist in a band where the songwriter is writing on piano is that the writer then wants them to play a lot of the parts in the kind of style that they've been written in. So most people, unless they're very, very amenable and don't have a strong style of their own, end up having some difficulties with the songwriter. So Conway did as well. I know one of his albums was called Wrong Man's Hands, and it's clearly a direct reference to the situation he was in The Bad Seeds, where he was the wrong man's hands on the piano. But he did really enjoy being in The Bad Seeds, don't get the wrong idea. And he got on very well with Nick a lot of the time and can have very high regard for Nick's songwriting. But there are certain difficulties with him being on that instrument.
I want to hear a little bit of Conway's solo songwriting. Too Dark to See is one of his. You feature on this as well, playing guitar. Let's take a little piece of that.
When you're lying to me,
that is the gorgeous sound of Too Dark to See. It's Conway Savage from his self-titled EP in 1993 that you played on, Mick. And you're playing three gigs in Ireland next month, starting with the tribute show at the Spirit Store Friday the 12th. Can you tell us a little bit about the other musicians who are involved? Susie Higgy, Terry Edwards, Amanda Acevedo, they're on the bill as well.
Yes, there'll be a lot of people coming along, including Jim Yamaridis, who was from The Stream, which was a band that Conway was a great supporter of, and Robbie Tickner, who was in that band, and Amanda Acevedo will be there singing. I'll be there. Also, Susie Higgy, with whom Conway did an album with a lot of duets on them, and Terry Edwards. I don't know what Terry's doing, playing saxophone, but Terry can do just about anything. So.
You've been writing and releasing your own albums for the last couple of decades, at least, Mick. You've also produced albums, including PJ Harvey's Let England Shake. What do those collaborations bring to you as a musician?
Well, I mean, my thing is primarily that's what I do. I kind of work with people and create, I'm a collaborative musician who works in small ensembles usually. So that's kind of where my strength lies. So if I'm doing my solo recordings, then I'm just using the tools that I have and the things that I've learned from all of those kind of undertakings where I've been working with this, with quite a large array of people I've worked with over the years. And you really do learn something from all. Everybody has different approaches and different ways of seeing how music should be made, or what their opinions about how to go about it, or their techniques. So you pick up a lot from everyone you work with.
We're going to finish with something of yours, with the song When We Were Beautiful and Young, and it comes from your recent solo album, Five Ways to Say Goodbye. Would you tell us a little bit about that and then maybe introduce it for us as well?
So I've been working a lot with Amanda Acevedo. We've done two albums And in the middle of those two albums, I just put out this solo album. I think I've been putting too much stuff out there. I think I'm scaring people by releasing an album every year. It's not the 70s anymore. But that particular song that's on that album, I just wrote in response to, actually, I wrote it in response to just the passing of the years, I guess. And it's a sort of reflective song about, hopefully not too sentimental. It's meant to be just looking at the realities of that condition, of the change and of time passing. And it's almost celebrating it more than, you know, mourning the loss of things. It's really, I would hope, a kind of, it has a positive feel ultimately to it.
Let's take a listen to that. This is When We Were Beautiful. You. And young Mick Harvey, thanks so much for talking to us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
In a spiral of those who couldn't cope. And there was some.
Mick Harvey and others play the songs of Conway Savage on the 12th of September at the Spirit Store in Dundalk as part of the weekend festival These Are the Waves. Mick plays his own show with Amanda Acevedo at the White Horse, Ballincollig, County Cork on Saturday, September 13th, and then he'll be returning to the Spirit Store the following day, Sunday, September 14th. More details on all of those at spiritstore.ie, and you'll find the Conway Savage Festival in Dundalk on Instagram at These Are the Waves 2025. Now, Conor McPherson's much-loved play The Weir opened last night at the Three Olympia Theatre in Dublin. The writer himself directs the story of five people who come together in a rural pub one evening to tell tales of the supernatural to one another. Brendan Gleeson, Tom Vaughan Lawler, Sean McGinley, Owen McDonnell and Kate Phillips make up the cast. Paula Shields went to see The Weir for us and she's with me now in studio. Paula, Conor McPherson's written a lot of successful plays since The Weir, Not Least Girl from the North Country, the musical based on the songs of Bob Dylan. But this was early. This was the breakthrough hit for him and it's still one of his most popular works.
Yes, the writing of The Weir itself is a great origin myth. He was all of 25, Conor. He wrote it in 10 days. The first draft essentially is what we're still looking at on stage. It was a commission from the Royal Court, which was a cool, well-known new writing house at the time. But, you know, they booked it into a tiny space for 3 or 4 weeks. And then it runs and runs and runs. It moves to a bigger theatre in London. It wins awards. It goes to Broadway. It's a kind of dream start any writer, musician, artist would be thrilled to have.
Where are we here in this story? Where do we begin?
It's set in 1996, which would have been the year he wrote it. It's a rural pub somewhere in Leitrim, Sligo. There's mention of a town called Carrick. Mayo gets a lot of mentions. It's a kind of a backwater. It's a pub that belongs to a farm as well. There are these local regulars. It's not a pub that's hiving, apart from when the German tourists come in. There's much talk about them, but that's an annual event, not every day of the week. And there are three guys in the bar, the barman himself, played by Owen McDonnell, Brendan Gleeson's character, Jack, who's an older man, who's a mechanic, and then Jim, played by Sean McGinley, who is a kind of sidekick of Brendan Gleeson's. He's a part-time mechanic, can turn his hand to anything. And they're all talking because this woman who's down from Dublin, who's single and who's married matters in this play. She's just bought a house in the area, and someone they know, someone they grew up with, who's made good, Finbar, played by Tom Vaughan Lawler, he sold the house to her and he's about to bring her in and kind of show off that he's got this woman on his arm and this is the latest drama. So there's a lot of kind of slight bitching going on to begin with, and then these two people appear.
And Valerie then turns out essentially to be the catalyst for everything that happens afterwards.
Well, that's right. And she's played brilliantly by Kate Phillips. But, you know, all of a sudden these middle-aged men, to be fair, most of them, the barman's a little bit younger and that matters, but they all turn into schoolboys and they start telling stories and they're all desperate to impress. And there's a lot of comedy to be had in this. And Conor's brilliant writing ekes it out. So there's a lot of jostling, and they know stories about one another because they've grown up together. So there's a lot of digging and needling and then pulling it back. And all the while we're learning about the rivalry between Jack and Finbar, for example, or just the dynamics of this group of people.
It's set in 1996, around the time the original play was written. So that's almost 30 years ago at this stage. We're obviously looking at a very, very different Ireland.
Yes. One of the joys of going to see this play in 2025 is you're going, oh my goodness, they're smoking in pubs. Finbar brandishes a £20 note at one point, when £20 was clearly a lot of money and more than enough to pay for a round of drinks in a pub. There are no phones. There's no internet. The Owen MacDonald, Brendan's character, you realise he has land. There's talk about land. You know, he could sell it, but what's the point? It won't reach much in terms of auctions. And you're thinking, what a contrast to now. And then these stories that involve fairy forts remind me of our grandparents' generation, when these stories would have been much more common. But in some ways, it's quite funny to look at that Ireland and think a lot of that has vanished.
So a lot of that has changed, but ultimately, human concerns don't really change in enormous amounts. Tell me about the big themes that run across the Weir.
So the play still comes across as fresh, and that's in the writing, it's in the characterisation. Macpherson has real talent for dialogue. The play is about the need for human connection. It's about loss. It's about home. It's about storytelling and how storytelling, in a way, can save us. It's about the choices people make and looking back later in life. And it's just about how mysterious life is and how connection will save us.
People tend to forget just how funny a writer Conor Macpherson is. I saw The Brightening Air earlier this year in the Old Vic, that production. It's a very, very funny play, and it's a strand that runs through most of his work. Is that true here?
Yes. He's able to shift mood and tone in the most unlikely places. So there is obviously real pathos in this play. There's a lot of knockabout jostling. There's some physical slapstick. Tom Von Lawler's character, Finbar, is the flash guy done well with his local hotel, and he's very competitive with Jack. And at some points, he's high-kicking in a martial arts style. You know, there's a lot of peacocking going on, but it's in the language as well. You know, the dialogue is very, they're chopping and changing over one another and showing one another up. But at a certain point, after Valerie has told her outrageously heartbreaking story, there's dead silence, and even in the audience you're thinking, well, there's no answer to that. And Sean McGinley has the line of the evening in many ways, where I'm not going to spoil Valerie's story, but all he says is, maybe it was a wrong number, and the whole place erupts. And that's in the writing as well as in the excellent playing from Sean.
Because part of this is about the building of the stories as they happen one by one. Jack, Finbar, Jim, they tell their stories. What do you think he's trying to do there?
Well, I think Conor Macpherson's always had an interest in the supernatural, and he did a philosophy degree. And one of the inspirations for this play is the fact that, because I was thinking, well, Conor's a Dubliner. What interest has he, or what knowledge has he of rural Ireland? But his grandfather lived in Leitrim, and he would visit him as a teenager. And the grandfather was widowed at this stage, so he knew something of, you know, turning the radio on for company, say. But the grandfather would tell a lot of these stories. So the story that Brendan Gleeson tells, first of all, about the fairy fort nearby and the consequences of that and the weird knocking on the door and don't answer the door, that's a story from Jack Macpherson.
No spoilers here, obviously, but Brendan Gleeson's character is the only one who then gets to tell a second story as well. And it kind of brings us back to the central theme.
Yes, because we know there are three stories told and they're increasingly creepy, and there is a kind of child theme. And then Valerie, who's very comfortable in these men's company and who's very interested in these stories, very likeable outsider, she tells her story, and that much is made of that in general to do with the Weir. But actually the play ends with another quite long story from Brendan Gleeson's character. It's not supernatural. It's about the girl who got away, the girl he might have married 30 years earlier. And it's about how she goes up to Dublin and he can't follow. He's not comfortable in Dublin, and that's not going to happen. But it reminds you of, you know, there's an idea of these men put a face on in public. Even someone, you know, Jack has his own garage. He has a certain life. These men are more at home in the pub, maybe, than they are in their own houses. But he doesn't come out well of this story, and he admits that. But it brings you back to that idea of it's connection we need. Something happens here with the telling of these stories. They kind of bond with one another, I think.
And in terms of Conor McPherson as a director, for him to be now directing a play that originally was such an enormous part of his life as a writer, do you think that he brings something to that as a director now as well?
I do. I think he's an actor's director. I think he's happy to have the actors play and have suggestions. When you hear him, he was in the studio a few weeks ago, and when you hear him talk about that, he's open to a certain kind of anarchy. I think he's a very skilled director because he's directed so much since then. Originally, it would have been The Royal Court, Ian Rickson, who directed it. But he gets great performances out of everybody, and I think that's a testament to a director. The lines land where they should.
Yeah, I thought the same when I saw The Brightening Air earlier this year. He directed that as well, and particularly for Sean McGinley's character, he was also in that at the Old Vic earlier this year. And Chris O'Dowd's character, who's one of the main characters in that, I thought he was absolutely fantastic. In terms of the performances that you saw here, then, did you rate them?
Yes. It's an excellent cast. It's a rare opportunity to see people like Brendan Gleeson and Tom Von Lawler and Owen MacDonald on a Dublin stage. We would have seen them a lot 20 years ago. Mm. Kate Phillips is fantastic as well. People might know her from Peaky Blinders or Wolf Hall. But Sean McGinley, who is always on the stage here and must be seen every time, I firmly believe, you know, is extraordinary. But it's a fantastic ensemble.
Paula Shields, thank you. The Weir by Conor McPherson is at the 3 Olympia Theatre, Dublin, until the 6th of September. As far as I'm aware, it is all sold out, but it does transfer to the Harold Pinter Theatre in London from the 12th of September to the 6th of December, if you happen to be there. More info at 3olympia.ie and landmarkproductions.ie. Tonight's programme, produced by Sinead Egan. Research was by Paula Shields. Broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton, and Niall McMonagle was on sound. I'll talk to you tomorrow night from 6:30, where we review the best of the new music and this week's new TV. John Creedon is next.